Freedom Show, The Wake Up Call, on WCOM LP, Chapel Hill in Carrboro. I'm Dick Paddock, co-host and engineer, looking at me across the table, wondering if I'll ever get my act together, is our co-host Lori Hoyt, and our guests today are Steve Wolford and Lenore Yarger.
Well, welcome to our guests, Steve and Lenore, and we have two more guests.
That's true.
Yes, their whole family is here, and we have Minnie and Quinn. And so there's the whole Yarger-Wolford family is here, and we're just delighted they've come in spite of this weather. They braved the flooded roads to come in from Silcope. And we're delighted that they could make it. We've known Steve and Lenore for many, many, many years, and are delighted that they could come, because I found out from Dick today that it was today, or it would be quite a while, that you're going on a 3-month sabbatical. Is that true?
Yes. We work for Quaker House in the GI Rights Hotline, and we've been doing that work for how many years now? About 15 years, and they have been generous to give us a 3-month sabbatical, so we're going to take our whole family down to Nicaragua and study Spanish and try to learn the language so we can come back and talk better to our friends.
That is exciting. Oh, my goodness. We're making good use of the sabbatical. So as Lenore mentioned, I'll just mention again, they have two big jobs, I guess I could say, not counting being parents and having a family and having a marriage to keep going, but also they, in addition to working for Quaker House and the GI Hotline, Steve and Lenore, I think before you did that, started the Catholic Worker House in Silcope, and at that time, that was, I think, the second Catholic Worker House in this area. I think Patrick O'Neill had the first. So it often east of Raleigh. So a lot of our listeners may not know what we're talking about. So if one or both of you could tell us what is a Catholic Worker House and a little bit of the history of it, because it's to me really exciting, and I'd love to hear. Have our listeners know about this wonderful project.
So the Catholic Worker is, we say, a movement. It's not really an organization. It's a movement of people across the country and even the world who adhere to a tradition that's very important to us that was started by Dorothy Day and Peter Morin back during the Depression. And they started a newspaper called The Catholic Worker, which really championed the rights of the poor and working class, drawing on the teachings of the Catholic Church, which were really quite radical in terms of social justice. And they were selling their paper for a penny a copy on the streets of New York City and started to build up a bit of a following. And people started knocking on their door, asking them about the houses of hospitality that they advocated for. And they opened a worker house where they offered shelter to homeless folks and served a big soup line and fed people on the streets of New York City. And they also, at the same time, they were trying to address the needs of the poorest in their society. They were also trying to draw attention to the things of the world that sap resources away from all people, like war and war making. And so they were also nonviolent advocates for an end to militarism and war making. And building community to kind of offer an alternative. And Peter Morin had a vision that we would return to the land and grow a lot of our own food, and farmers would help train the scholars, and scholars would come out and be farmers, and we would build community on the land. So he was also an important part of that vision. And today there's over 150 Catholic worker communities around the world. We are one of them, a very small one, out in Silcope. We moved out there in 1998, and with the intention of growing a lot of our own food and offering hospitality to homeless women and families out in our area, which is Chatham County, out near Siler City. and at the same time still working for peace and justice nonviolently in the world.
And I think that Peter really not only thought it was a good idea, didn't he start a huge vegetable garden outside the city, to grow all the vegetables that they would need to make all these big pots of soup? Another friend of yours and of mine, I'm blocking on his name, Francis Coyle, I think when he was young, worked in that garden and
helped. So there was I think what you're talking about, Laurie, there have been many different kinds of Catholic worker houses, and I think Lenore touched on that some. There have been some that are urban houses.
Uh-huh.
There aren't that many suburban ones. There have been urban houses that have been largely shelters, and there still are plenty of houses like that. We have friends in Philadelphia who have a small shelter. Then they have a clinic for homeless people. They've expanded to have a dental clinic, a medical clinic, and provide support in a lot of different ways. Some houses serve soup lines or meals to people in town. And then along the lines of what you're saying, Peter Morin had a vision for a more rural movement. And his vision was places out in the country where people would live in a self-sustaining way. And the phrase he used was the workers would be scholars and the scholars would be workers. And this was going to be a classless place where everyone pitched in to help and everyone pitched in to think and clarify and make decisions about where they were going and where society was going.
Okay, so that wasn't just to provide the food for the urban soup kitchens in New York. It was.
It wound up doing that. And there's still a farm in New York that provides an awful lot of the produce for one of the Catholic worker houses, one of the original houses in New York.
Okay.
And that's the farm that when you mentioned our friend Francis. He had lived there or at least visited there a good bit.
Yeah, I think he worked on that farm and also drove the truck with the food into the city. I don't know how long he did that, but I just was fascinated when he told me about that.
And maybe to bring things back a little, you mentioned to the local where at one point I think there were only two houses in the area. Our two houses are still there, that ours and the one in Garner. And since that time, there's another house in East Durham, the Isaiah House.
Yes.
There's a house in Durham called the Rutba House, or a community, I'd say. They have several buildings. I don't know if they call themselves a Catholic worker house, but they're really in this same family, and they're inspired by the Catholic worker, and they're doing great things similar to what people are doing in the Catholic worker movement. Then there was another house in Durham that's just moved out into our county from being somewhat of an urban house to being a rural house. And I think at least several of the families are moving out into Chatham County outside of Pittsburgh and are planning on having a more agrarian vision. So there's really a wide range of, I guess, urban to rural kinds of operations out there.
And wasn't there one in Raleigh also? Is that still there where they were going to be there for the families of families of prisoners?
That one was up for a while and closed down.
And
I was going to say, the exciting thing about all these communities is that they're largely run now by families. And I think Patrick O'Neill and Mary Ryder at the Father Charlie Mulholland Catholic Worker in Garner have been really inspirational to us. They were doing this before we were as a family. And just it's exciting to see people with young children still opening up their home to the strangers and welcoming folks and still working for nonviolence in the world and really setting an example, I think, for what a new vision for how we can live our lives.
And speaking of them families, as I mentioned earlier, we have two members of your family here with you, and I wondered if they wanted to say something to our audience about living in Silcope or living in a Catholic worker house, or what? Do you just want to say hi?
Okay. Well, I think it's really nice to meet new people when they move into your home.
Yeah.
And then it's really nice to just know them. And then when they move out, just have them as a friend.
That sounds wonderful. It really does. And have them live with you a little while to get on their feet, and then they stay being friends with you. And Nina, you want to?
Nina, do it's nice to have a lot of, like he said, to have a lot of people come and to get to meet a lot of new people. And for a while, we would meet people, and then we'd just lose contact with them. And then one family came, and they inspired us. And so now I've kept contact with a lot of people, and it's great.
So that's wonderful. So you get to know a lot more people than most people get to know. Now, are you old enough to be going to school, or?
I'm homeschooled. You're both homeschooled.
You're both homeschooled. So do you get, are there other kids to play with in your neighborhood? Do you get to play with other kids?
I get to play with other kids, and we live in the middle of nowhere, so there's no neighborhood.
But you get to play with other kids?
Yeah.
In other ways.
5 miles away is a neighbor in our territory. going 5 miles for another kid isn't unreasonable. There are some other kids near us as well.
Yeah, when you live in the country, miles are a little different, aren't they?
Right.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, too, that Nini and Quinn are a huge part of our hospitality at our house, that people who come to stay with us are really drawn out of themselves by their energy, and they're both pretty extroverted when it comes to other people, and it's really helped to make people feel welcome and to feel like they're just living with a family. And there was one woman years ago who stayed with us who was very going through a very difficult time and was very private, and when she moved out, she left us a letter, and she said that it was really Nini who had really made her feel at home and comfortable living with us, and she was so grateful.
That's
for
someone,
that
is,
and I think they both have gifts in that area. And
I was going to say, we've seen that with a lot of families. I think for someone who's homeless, you're not always choosing where you're going, and you might have lost a sense of personal power in a lot of ways, often due to forces beyond your control. And when they come, they're living in somebody else's house, and you know, they're not familiar with this space and what these new rules are going to be like. And it's just I think that's a hard space for anybody to come into someone else's space and be figuring that out. Time and time again, I think kids make that transition so much easier for people. And it just seems like that makes them feel more relaxed. And a lot of times people are shy about asking, you know, where does the recycling go? And they're much more comfortable to ask a young person.
They don't feel as intimidated.
Where do these go? Where are the coffee cups?
Yeah.
And our wonderful children are always ready to show them where things are and lead them around and share their lives and how things work and how they go.
So this is a real family enterprise. It's not like Steve and Lenore, you're doing this and the kids just happen to be in the house too as your children. They're an integral part of what makes the Catholic Worker House work for the people who are your guests. And that's wonderful. And when you think about when your kids grow up, what an education they've had outside of anything academic. What an education in human relationships and how to get along with people and how to adapt to different people. That's just really wonderful. What a gift. What a gift you give the people who come to your house, and what a gift you are to them. That's great.
And I think it also works both ways. Before Christmas, we're leaving for the sabbatical in a week, and we weren't sure how close up to that time we could take somebody in who might need a temporary place to stay. And we decided to welcome a woman who needed a few weeks, and she was such a gift for us, and we all loved her. It made me so glad that we had decided to do that at a time that could have been pretty hectic and busy, but she fit really well with our family, and I felt like I had gotten to know somebody that otherwise I never would have met. And so it really has been a gift for us too, and some of our best friends we've met through offering hospitality.
Yeah.
So we're really lucky that way.
So how many, you probably can just take one or two at a time. How many bedrooms do you have? I know it's not that big a house.
Well, we used to have more. We have a lot of different rooms, and we used to fill them up with people. And we found now with the homeschooling and the GI Rights Hotline and some of the other work we do that we really we have one bedroom right now that we're opening up to. So, mm-hmm. So it would either be a single woman or a family that might come. Mm-hmm. And that's just, right now, that's what we can do, and there's an ebb and flow to this work, and it's at times we've taken in more, and this is just where we're at right now, but it feels like the right fit for our family right now.
So we've been mentioning about the GI Hotline, so that's another big part of your commitment to social justice, and want to tell our listeners what that is about. And
we can, although I think, Quinn, was there something else you wanted to say about our house?
Yeah.
You seemed like you wanted to get people's attention a second ago.
Sure.
You forgot what that
was. At any time, okay. We can go back and forth. We don't have to leave the topic of the Catholic Worker House. We can weave this back and forth. It's fine. So if you think of something that you wish you'd said, you're talking to people, and then you go home and say, oh, I wish I'd remembered to say that. Or so we have time. As long as you're here, we're happy to switch subjects anytime.
Well, I'd like to put the GI Rights Hotline in the context of what we do, and just maybe to clarify, every Catholic Worker House kind of has its own mission or group of missions that it picks, and those can change over time. Sometimes a community will have 7 or 8 people living there, and it might take on a lot, and then 3 or 4 of those people might move on to something else in life, and it's okay to let go of some of the things you were doing when you had more energy.
Sure.
So currently in our house, I think part of the reason we chose the area we did was we wanted to be able to do a good bit of gardening. Mm-hmm. So land had to be relatively affordable. Mm-hmm. We were living in Durham at the time, but to get a decent sized space, we weren't finding anything right in Durham that we could pay for.
Mm-hmm.
We also wanted a house that was big enough that would have some extra rooms for mm-hmm. people who needed a place to stay. And that's, both of those are things we're doing. And along with the gardening, we've done some just other sustainability type things. You might remember we've built a kind of alternative house out there.
Oh, that's
our
right.
cabin.
And, yeah.
And some other, we've just kind of explored simple living in some different ways. And then peace and justice has been a big part of things. And there have been a number of different issues over the peace and justice issues we've been involved in over the years. But opposing war has been one of the bigger ones. And
you have the Friday.
We do a peace vigil on the street.
The
right?
vigil every Friday.
Dick is a regular attender.
Yeah.
A lot of WILF members are there regularly. So where I was going with this, I think part of our experience as anti-war activists was demonstrating in front of military bases. And at times, we've even blockaded the entryways to bases at times as part of different anti-war protests. And in some of those situations, it felt very strange that on the other side of the fence, we'd be outside the base, there's this fence around the perimeter, there would be people who, members of the military who don't really have any say or decision-making in where the United States invades or where they're deployed or what's going on. They're doing what they're told or they get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Often they're people who are just trying to get a job and get some decent, support and benefits and things like that for the family. So it felt kind of strange that here were these people on the other side of the fence that we weren't having any contact with at all. And it felt problematic to me that it looked like we were directing our message at them because they were the people around, when really we were trying to speak to leaders about, mm-hmm. What the United States military footprint looks like worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And so some years ago, people at Quaker House approached Lenore and asked her if she could be a board member for the organization. And I think Lenore was a good board member, but I don't think she found that particularly as exciting. And while she was a board member,
maybe you could just briefly say what Quaker House
is. Quaker House is. So Quaker House, I'll say that in a second.
I don't want you to lose your
Quaker practice. House is one of the groups that runs the GI Rights Hotline.
Okay.
Where we work. So that's part of this connection to the GI Rights. Maybe I'll say more about that, too. I'll try to put all this together in a clear story. There was a need for volunteer counselors at Quaker House. And those were counselors that would be answering calls to the GI Rights Hotline. And we both were really interested in doing that and got trained to do that. So we started as volunteers. And then Quaker House had a staffing change where the current director moved to Sri Lanka a couple years before his contract was up. And we didn't really want to run the organization But we wanted to keep counseling, and we made a proposal to the board. How about we do this, you know, at least heavy part-time, and, you know, you can pay us something, and we'll keep the counseling going while you find a director.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of how we came into the job. And what the GI Rights Hotline is, there is a toll-free number for people in the military who are having problems, oftentimes, and family members also call, friends call, friends of service members. People are calling us primarily because they want to get out of the military. Mm-hmm. It's not working for them, and they want to figure out some kind of way out. There's also a lot of people who call with grievances. Hey, I'm not getting medical care for this problem that I should be getting medical care for. What do I do about that? There's a wide range of things people call us about, some of which I'd say we specialize in, you know, someone who has a family hardship or someone with medical issues. Another area we cover is what's called conscientious objection. And I don't know, you want to say something about, okay.
Well, let me just talk about conscientious objection and how that came about.
This would be a good place to fit in a break.
Okay.
We need to identify the station and tell what's going on.
We do this halfway through, and then you get a chance to catch your breath, think about what else you want to say, and we meet our legal obligation to give this station.
Yes, this is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom show, the wake-up call. Being brought to you over radio station WCOM-LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Our show is underwritten by Internationalist Bookstore on Lloyd Street in Carrboro.
And
the show is presented by the Triangle Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which you can find at its website of triangle.wilpf.org. That's triangle.wilpf.org. And the station's website is wcomfm.org. That's wcomfm.org.
Can they hear all that when you're during the station break?
Yeah.
Sorry.
We're going back now to the show. I'm sorry I interrupted.
Can
you
I just make one quick announcement?
Sure, go ahead.
I just don't want to forget this. On January 10th, there's going to be a fundraiser for the Chatham County struggle against fracking. Coal ash. The Chatham County. Right. A struggle against coal ash, and they're going to have a fundraiser on January 10th in downtown Moncure at 2:30. It's going to be a gospel sing. And so First Baptist, Missionary Baptist Church, something like that, in downtown Moncure. So I just want to give a heads up about that.
It'll be the one that has all the cars parked around it.
Yes, mark your calendar for downtown Moncure. Okay, back to our guests. We're talking with Steve Wolford and Lenore Yarger and their two children, Quinn and Nini, and who are running the Catholic Worker House in Silcoke, and also Lenore and Steve are also running the GI Hotline for Quaker House along with some other organizations, and we've just started talking about their work with the hotline, but if it's needed for anybody wanting to bring anything back up about the Catholic Worker House, we can. Okay, Steve and Lenore, we were talking about conscientious objectors.
Yeah, so I thought I'd just share the history of Quaker House briefly because that's a good way to understand conscientious objection. Quaker House started during the Vietnam War when a young soldier, Dean Holland, hitchhiked up to Chapel Hill from Fort Bragg and went to the Quakers at the Friends meeting here in Chapel Hill and asked for help because he felt like he could no longer participate in war because of his religious and moral beliefs. And so Chapel Hill Friends, Raleigh Friends, and Durham Friends meeting all grouped together and began the organization Quaker House by purchasing a home in Fayetteville and just started supporting all the soldiers there who were seeking help with conscientious objection.
How many years ago was that?
So that was in the 19th. Yeah. Well, it's been almost, we're approaching our 50th anniversary. So
oh, my gosh.
We're not quite that there yet, but in the next 5 years, I think. So, and the organization persevered after the war, despite there was a firebombing of the house, and a couple of the young directors were killed in a car accident. There's been a lot of challenges, but the organization has persevered largely because of the wonderful people who have supported Quaker House over the years and the boards that have come to work and support the work of the director. And we were working with Dean Holland and people like him who were, you know, opposed to participating in war. And gradually, we just started helping anybody who needed help, because we realized that, in the words of one of the attorneys we work with, everyone in the military is either a conscientious objector or a potential conscientious objector. And then one thing is for sure, that everyone who works in the military is a victim of militarization and the way in which the military is organized and run. And that's become very clear to us over the years as we've done this work. And and then in 1994, a group of organizations, including the Center on Conscience and War in D.C. and the Central Committee on Conscientious Objection in California and Philadelphia, we all started to talk. We were all doing similar work, and that's when we pulled together and started this 800 number, the GI Rights Hotline. And over the years, that, you know, with the introduction of the internet, you know, prior to the internet, it was word of mouth and newspapers, and people were finding us that way. But the internet really just skyrocketed the number of people who could find us. And
so you get much busier. As about how I know there's probably no average day, but about how many calls do you anticipate getting on
a at day? Quaker House, with our statistics, we usually get between 200 and 300 calls a month.
Wow.
And that's people who, there's other people who maybe, that's not counting like messages or people who we can't really get through to or can't help. That's people who we actually are giving concrete information to.
Mm-hmm.
While we're on the subject, just in case someone out there listening needs to call the GI Rights,
you can
search us online and you'll usually find the GI Rights website. But the phone number is 877-447-4487. That's a toll-free number that probably the majority of people who reach us through that number. Some people call our branch, our Quaker House branch, directly, and that information's on our website as well.
And let's give that at the end of the program.
We can repeat that for anybody who's that.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So I knew you were busy, but that's much higher traffic than I realized. That's a lot.
You know, when we started, it was before September 11th. And I think recruiters would say to people, you know, this is just money for college. You're not really going to go fight somewhere.
Yeah.
And I know that recruiters, you know, they vary to the extent that they're painting the truest picture. But I think there was a sense, I don't know that they felt like they were making something up entirely when they said that.
Yeah.
After September 11th, a whole lot of people realized, wait a minute, being in the military means you're going to deploy somewhere and you're going to be in a war zone.
You may not make it back.
And you may not, or you may have a whole lot of issues, and you know, some of the issues show up right away, some of the issues don't show up till later.
Yeah.
But call volume picked up dramatically once those deployments started happening. What's interesting, and we don't know if we can explain this fully, we've backed away. I mean, people are still getting deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, the military hasn't stopped everything, but not in the numbers that they were before. It's it's cut back dramatically, although our call volume continues to increase.
And really?
We haven't really seen, you might think you'd get fewer conscientious objectors after, you know, a backing away from deployments, but we haven't found that either. In fact, we're as busy as we've ever been with people calling, wanting to know about conscientious objection. In fact, this morning, I answered a call from someone who wanted to know more about conscientious objection and see if it applied to him. So our call volume, you know, continues to increase, And we don't know if that's just that more people are finding us, if more people are dissatisfied. They may be calling about slightly different reasons, but a lot of the same reasons are still there. But it's a busy place.
So you are able to do that out of your home.
Mm-hmm. We are, and Quaker House still has a house in Fayetteville.
Yeah.
And the hotline is just part of what we do. Steve and Lynn Newsom are the directors in Fayetteville, and they do a number of wonderful outreach programs, including there's a counselor for survivors of domestic violence who are affiliated with the military, mm-hmm. either through spouse or in the military, mm-hmm. And do a lot of anti-torture work. And it's great to have that physical location for some soldiers want to actually talk someone face-to-face and just mm-hmm. get some support, and that's been wonderful to have that there. But we are able to answer the hotline out of our home, which has been wonderful for us.
Yes.
With everything else we have going.
So, yeah, so I think there's a little bit of foot traffic of people coming into the office, you know, for live counseling in Fayetteville. Some mm-hmm. of it, like Lenore said, is specialized counseling. Some of it's just people wanting to know about what Quaker House does. Mm-hmm. But because there are only about 10 GI Rights offices, and there are military bases all over the country and internationally, we aren't able to speak to most of the people we talk to live.
Mm-hmm.
Or not when I say live, in person. We're talking to them live, but over the phone. So we're getting calls from people all over the country and even all over the world.
Okay, I didn't quite. So there's only 10?
I think there's about 10 offices where people are doing GI Rights hotline counseling in the United States.
In the whole country?
Mm-hmm. And ours is actually one of the biggest.
Oh, my God. I didn't realize that. You would think wherever there's a major base. I mean, I didn't think they were in every little town.
I wish we had.
That would be a nice target to have.
But is that yours big because it's so big? It's so next to Fort Bragg, which is such a huge.
I think big in the terms of call volume. Yeah. Because, I mean, and with cell phones, we get calls from all over the country, and we don't. You know, Hawaii, Alaska, you know, it's not just Fort Bragg soldiers. And some of those calls from Fort Bragg might end up being answered by someone somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
But if it's somebody who needs some local attention, then we certainly can provide it. But I think it's just because of the number. We have paid staff and the number of hours that we provide. We just get a lot of call volume, like Center on Conscience and War in D.C.
Mm-hmm. We're in when people are calling.
Yeah.
So are you the only two on this GI hotline, or do you have other people doing it with you?
We are Quaker House's only hotline staff, but there are a number of other counselors. When I say there's 10 offices, there are counselors in each of those offices.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A couple others have some paid staff, and then the rest are staffed by volunteers.
By volunteers. But you have to probably have some training, so.
Unfortunately, it takes a lot of training to really get good at it.
Yeah,
and it makes it harder just for us to get volunteers because you have to get people who are willing to stick with a lot of information.
Yeah, because you need if you're going to give advice to people, you need to know what you're talking about. I'm sure there's all kinds of legal, military, all kinds of ramifications. You have to be careful what you say, you know, not to give false hope. I mean, that's a difficult job.
And we're not attorneys, so we don't give advice, but we do try to give information. And we practice what we call non-directive counseling. And the idea behind that is that we're empowering the caller to make the best decision they can in their life,
mm-hmm.
and which is very contradictory to the way the military works. So we feel like in some ways it's part of undermining the military power structure that we feel is so damaging to people by taking away their opportunity to make choices
mm-hmm.
and to think for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
In our counseling, we try to present their options and give them as much information as to consequences as we can,
mm-hmm.
and then support them in whatever choice they make, which may not be our choice
mm-hmm.
for them. But mm-hmm. I think in that way, it's really important because it helps them to start to take control back over their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and also, yeah, I think some people I know in the anti-war movement are even disappointed when they hear that we're not telling people what to do.
Oh, really?
they think they know what everybody should be doing, and they want us to be telling them that. But we found it works better, and I mean, ethically, I feel better meeting people where they are, giving them information, helping them make their own choice,
mm-hmm.
especially since they're the ones that have to live with the consequences of
it?
Any choice they make. Some of the people who call us go AWOL and do things that could even, you know, lead to jail time or mm-hmm. lead to punishment and things like that. And someone really should know what they're getting into if they make a choice like that mm-hmm. and should be doing it for their own reasons rather than some person they just met over the phone telling yeah. them to do it. So, it's really important for us that we do non-directive counseling. And I think that's very respectful of the people. You know, I think the military is full of a lot of intelligent people who are ready to make good decisions. They just aren't getting very good information mm-hmm. to base those decisions on. The military, I think, only gives people the side of the story it wants them to hear to do what they want.
Yeah. So I think that's critical, though, for somebody in that position to have an ethical place, though, that knows the ramifications, the pros, the cons, the consequences, and can give that straightforward information. And you're absolutely right. Ethically, they have to live with the consequences if they... So I'm so mm-hmm. glad you do it the way you do it.
And maybe another piece of that, we don't really... Some people want us to be sort of changing other people's minds and telling them what to do, but we don't really need to do that either, because we have plenty of people calling us for help who have already... They're clear about what they want. We don't have to call someone up and say, why don't you become a conscientious objector? They're calling us up saying, I think I'm a conscientious objector. What do I do now?
Yeah.
And our job isn't to tell them to be one or not to be one, but to help them, for instance,
this is the avenues that
how
you
to go through
take.
The process, how to Use document this clearly, how to go about it in a way that's going to help you actually get out for conscientious objection.
So,
I thought it might be good to share a story or two about some of the people we've helped. And I thought maybe the young Marine woman that you worked with recently who was suicidal would be a good example if you feel up to telling that story. You were on the phone with her quite a bit. Maybe she wasn't a Marine.
There's a couple. One was in the Air Force and one was in the Navy.
Okay.
I'm thinking of. Well, Lenore's mentioning... And I think this is probably important to say, too. Most of the people who call us are not suicidal, currently, you know, having suicidal ideations or having a concrete plan of how they might carry that out.
Mm-hmm.
But a surprising number are, and I think that some years ago we started asking people, some incidents happened where people who seemed perfectly calm and rational after more conversation turned out to be in a great deal of distress. And so I think both of us ask people a lot more often and would rather err on the side of, you know, asking someone who's saying, oh, no, I'm not feeling that way. Because in doing so, we've actually talked to a lot of people who just needed that kind of a cue to start discussing how bad it is. And so we've actually dealt with a lot of people who are suicidal. Unfortunately, the way the military deals with that, sometimes I think they do make sure a person's safe if they think the person's suicidal. But as far as being a support network, they're not very good at validating what's going on for the person, especially because if you tell your commander about how you hate it here and everything that is wrong for you about being in the military, they don't have attention for that. they aren't going to tell you that's sure you're feeling that way. Of course, you're in this crazy system. Whereas by being outsiders, we're able to, I think, again, we're not really telling people what they need to feel. They're coming to us with this, but we're able to just validate what they're feeling and say that makes sense that you could feel that way with what's going on for you.
Yeah.
And then helping them figure out ways to get help. So I don't know exactly which details. Lenore was talking about a couple cases. There have been a number of people that I've spent a good bit of time with that have been suicidal. And afterward, they've talked about just having that connection of someone who was both helping them with resources, but also reminding them that they're not crazy. They're in a crazy situation.
Mm-hmm.
Has really been a lifeline that kept them going.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. A lot of the people we're helping, they need to know specifically what some regulation says about some certain situation, and we look up that regulation and we tell them what it says.
Mm-hmm.
Other times people call us, and we don't necessarily have a lot of concrete information, and there have been quite a few calls where I've talked to someone, and I felt like, geez, I'm not giving this person much to go on or much help at all, and at the end they say, thank you so much. This has been the most helpful conversation I have had in months.
Oh, my
God. And I realize that for so many people, having someone outside that system they're in, the military system, for people who have been in it, I think all know what I'm talking about, it starts to feel like a bubble where they control everything mm-hmm. in your life, and they tell you what you're supposed to do, and if you don't do it, they tell you what they're going to do to punish you, and mm-hmm. they really control so much of what you get to do and whether you get leave even, or when you know, get to go and come, and all sorts of other things, and how much punishment you get and how much pay you get. And so it really can feel like an oppressive system to people who aren't fitting in that. So oftentimes just having someone acknowledge what they're feeling is extremely meaningful for people. Mm-hmm. And I think for a number of these people who were having suicidal thoughts, we were able to get some of them real help as mm-hmm. well. And I think if it's a crisis, we're usually pretty clear that, you know, we want the person to agree to get help. We try to walk through steps of even getting them to a place, sometimes mm-hmm. even working with people in their command to make sure they get to a mental health facility or mm-hmm. something like that. But along the way, I mean, there's a longer process than that of them dealing with the overall situation of being in the military. And just a lot of those people, including, I don't know if I'm really telling this woman's story very well. Maybe Lenore wants to add. But just for a lot of people, that's a real helpful part of it, and that's as helpful as any specific piece of information they get is having an ally along the way.
Yeah.
Content.
Is that what you were thinking of? And mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other thing we see a lot of right now is people who have been on deployments, who have returned from deployments and are still in but maybe suffering from PTSD or other illnesses, and they might accidentally get mad at somebody, they might drink too much, self-medicating and drive, or they might do something that then gives the military the option of putting them out for misconduct. And if for misconduct, that means you don't get considered for disability, you don't get your benefits, you lose a lot.
Yeah.
And these are people who, you know, the U.S. has sent to war. And part of what we have been trying to do is show the connection between the mental health issue and the behaviors, because in that situation, the regulations support the processing the person out for disability and keeping their benefits and getting an honorable discharge. And it isn't exactly what I saw myself doing when I started doing the hotline, but I just realized that there's a real justice issue here.
There is.
Like, we are asking people, we're sending people into a war zone, they're coming back wounded, and then we're going to kick them out because we're not ready to care for them. And there's such a stigma.
Well, to recognize that the mm-hmm. behavior is based on an illness and punish them as though it's not.
And there's such a stigma. If you come back and you might show, you know, that maybe you have PTSD or depression or anxiety or something like that, any sign of that is considered weakness, and you can really be put down and ostracized by your command, and it's a very ugly thing that we see happening all the time. So you don't want to come forward and get help, or if you do come forward and get help, then they try to railroad you out for some other reason. And so part of it has just been fighting for these folks to, you know, like, look, if we're going to fight these wars, we need to pay the bill to take care of them afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we tallied up the cost of caring for every person in that situation, war would be way more expensive than it's already, you know, outrageously expensive. And I'm not sure that we could even afford to keep doing it. So I think it's holding the U.S. government and military accountable for their decisions if we're going to do this, and we prefer not to do it. I mean, obviously the answer is to not go to war and not put people in these situations. But in the situations where we have these wounded, that we need to be caring for them.
Well, good for you, because I've heard of that. You know, in situations, even when they've come back and applied for help, then they try to look back in their record. And so, I forget, there was some ridiculous case. It was on the news, you know, mm-hmm. where they said, oh, I think you had this problem in high school or something, of maybe attention deficit. I don't know, something where they wanted to deny.
Some years ago, that was a big deal. I think what you said, they aren't doing this now. I caught up with them because they did too much. But they were discharging people for personality disorder,
yes,
which they were saying
yes.
that was a pre-existing,
condition.
Consequently, we're not liable for your medical care for
now they use adjustment disorder. I mean, they do the same thing with adjustment disorders or these minor misconduct incidents. It's the same thing.
It's the same idea. But let's get out of fulfilling our responsibility because we're going to save some money, so it's out of whosever decision-making pocket that is. I mean, it's so unconscionable. It is so unconscionable.
Yeah. So. I think that's, yeah, I agree. I think what we're talking, there's kind of two layers to this, I think. Mm-hmm. We're really trying to help the individual caller who we're on the line with get this figured out. But at the same time, there is this big picture thing of, I think the government wants to have its wars, but it wants to have war on the cheap.
On the cheap.
Exactly. It doesn't want to pay the true costs. And so the bigger picture component of what we're doing is, if they have to start giving the care to people and realizing what war is doing to them, I mean, I think our hope is that they're going to say, wait a minute, this is too expensive in terms mm-hmm. of human costs and in mm-hmm. terms of dollars. They'd probably mm-hmm. listen more to dollars, mm-hmm. but that this is, it's not worth it to go in here.
Well, look at how many wars it's all after Vietnam, how many, all of a sudden the rate of homelessness increases so much and there's so many on the streets. It turns out that they're veterans. Every single war we've had, you know, people considered hobos or derelicts or whatever, and it turns out that they're veterans who never recovered from the war, right. And we don't take good care of them. And this has been an ongoing problem forever, and thank goodness there's people advocating like you guys and other people now that, you know, if you're going to send people to war, you have to take responsibility for when they come home for their help. And so you all are doing a Catholic Worker House, Quaker House with the GI Hotline, a garden, your parenting, homeschooling. Oh gosh, what do you do in your spare time?
Well, we just got a croquet set for Christmas.
You do what?
We just got a croquet set for Christmas.
Have you played it yet? We had a croquet set when I was a kid.
We've played it like every free chance we've gotten.
Yes, when we get in between.
Not very often, considering it's raining all the time.
We've played cross-country mud croquet.
Yes.
Or croquet, as we call it in our house.
Yeah.
Croquet.
Well, when it gets
says on the box.
It's mostly in the box, I bet, right now. But when springtime comes, if we ever get dry weather again, which we have to hope for, unless we're going to all get rowboats, you know, it's a lot of fun. I had so much fun with that when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Croquet?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. We still do a lot of, I think, pretty normal things with our lives. We have baseball games and softball games and violin lessons and gymnastics and pottery classes and all sorts of ordinary things like that, too. But we stay busy.
You stay busy, and now you're going to have a little break, a little break?
We got to take lessons now. I'm not getting the break part.
Well, it's going to be fun, though. It's going to be fun in a new place and learning to speak Spanish.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to making something out of clay.
Oh, so you're gonna do pottery while you're there?
I don't even do pottery.
Huh?
I don't even do pottery.
I
do it here.
You do it here already. So you just get, now you'll be doing Spanish pottery.
Spanish. It's gonna happen.
Spanish design pottery. I bet you're gonna have a good time.
I hope to make a Duke mug.
Okay.
Only because I came back with the UNC.
Start cutting things off.
So how far away is Nicaragua? You're going to have a geography lesson just getting there, huh?
5 hours.
5 hours? And how many?
Far enough to be a plane ride.
5 hours on the plane.
Haven't studied geography much in homeschool yet.
Well, this is going to be a geography lesson, whether you want to study it or not. It's going to be a big geography lesson. Yeah. What are the products of Nicaragua? Well, I hope you all have this absolutely wonderful time. And give us the hotline number again.
Right. So for anyone interested in calling the GI Rights hotline, the number is 877-447-4487. The website is girights.org or girightshotline.org.
Okay. So people all over the country are calling in, and they are so lucky to have the phone answered by either Steve Wolford or Lenore Yarger, giving them really good counseling and really good advice. And we wish you, when do you leave?
Too soon.
January 8th, also known as a week after New Year's.
Yeah. Okay, so you're going to be here for New Year's, and you got your grandparents here for at least tonight.
Yeah, they're leaving tomorrow.
They're leaving tomorrow on their way to Florida. Wow. So I hope you have a
And after Florida to Germany.
Well, I'm not going to Germany. You just said they were.
They're at least getting to Florida. We'll agree on that.
A little problem with the itinerary, I see.
And this is the WILF radio show, the wake-up call. This is Lori Hoyt. This is Dick Paddock. And we'll be with you next Wednesday with a mystery guest. We have to get on the stick.
We have to scratch up a guest.
We have to start doing some...
First show of the new year.
Yeah. So have a wonderful trip. And, yeah...
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
It was fun being here on the radio with you, Lori, and Dick. Thanks for asking us to come here.
Thank you for coming. We learned so much.
Which is, of course, what we're doing.
Yeah.
Always go for Duke.
So thank you again very much, Steve and Lenore, and we'll see you in 3 months or so out on the picket line again.
Back on the corner, right?
Yes.
Great. Thanks.
Palestine. And we hope you enjoyed it. This has been the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom show, The Wake Up Call. See you again next week.
Tune in for Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater, Tuesdays 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., right here on WCOM LP, Chapel Hill, Carborough, your community radio station.